Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you the story of Mary Ward, an Englishwoman, Benedict XVI, recently placed on the way to sainthood. But first, spotlight on Christian Unity Week. The yearly week of prayer for Christian unity, which invites the whole Christian community throughout the world to pray in communion with the prayer of Jesus, that they all may be one, began on Monday, 18th of January. This year, the theme is taken from the Gospel of St. Luke, that you may be witnesses. The week comes to a close on Sunday with Pope Benedict XVI presiding over Vespers in St. Paul's outside the walls. In an effort to find out more about this solemn celebration, I turned to the abbot of the Benedictine monastery attached to this basilica, his Father Edmund Power. I began by asking him about the ties of St. Paul's outside the walls to ecumenism.
I would say would be that it's because of the character of Paul himself. We know that Paul is an apostle without limits to his vision. From the very beginning, it was he who believed that the gospel was for all nations, whereas the other apostles needed quite a lot of convincing to accept that. I think that fact means that Paul has been kind of venerated in a particular way by all branches of the whole Christian communion, whether Protestant, Orthodox, or Catholic. And I think that fact, that he's not anybody in particular's possession, means that he's a very good apostle, his eye always on Christ, his eye always on the mission. And of course, the mission of Christianity is one of the main reasons why we have to have unity, not only because Christ prayed for it, which is a good enough reason in itself, but also because if we are to preach the gospel as Christ asked us to do, we have to do it together in today's world. We probably had to do it together always, but history has shown that there's been these divisions. So Paul is a particularly good patron, I would say, and the fact that this is his burial place and his shrine means that this basilica takes on something of his charism.
Because it has a history anyway during the 20th century of landmark events. I mean, John 23rd called the Second Vatican Council here, no?
Yeah, he didn't in fact call it in the basilica. He called it in the monastery, in the abbot's parlour. There's been a number of events held at St. Paul's. That's understandable in a way. There's very pragmatic reasons, because in some ways it's the most accessible of the four great basilicas, but also it's the second largest basilica in Rome, more sort of open than the others.
Pope Benedict came to your church the day after his solemn inauguration as the 264th successor of Peter. Do you think that he's singled out your basilica in a special way?
No, I think that his action was totally and utterly logical in terms of the whole kind of theology of the Roman Church. I think he made the obvious gesture, which is to recognize the fact that the Church of Rome is based on Peter and Paul, never on Peter alone and never on Paul alone, but on Peter and Paul. It's true that Peter took on much greater prominence in the course of the centuries, and that's reflected, for example, in the great prominence of his basilica. Everybody thinks St. Peter's. But in fact, the Roman Church is based on the witness of Peter and Paul. And the Holy Father, who's got a very good sense of history, realizes that, it's clear. And the fact that when he inaugurated his ministry as Bishop of Rome at St. Peter's on the 24th of April, I think it was totally right that immediately afterwards he should come and take possession of the Basilica of St. Paul, where the other apostle, equally important for Rome, is buried. And so that gesture, I think, was a wonderful demonstration of the origins of the Roman Church on the faith of the Keeper of the Keys and of the Preacher to the Nations.
Who decides how the liturgy is going to take place? Do you do it yourselves at St. Paul's,
or is it the Pope's
liturgist?
In fact, we're not involved at all, really, in any direct way in the organization of the planning of the actual liturgy. For a papal liturgy, wherever the Holy Father celebrates, it's in the hands of the director of the papal liturgies, who's Monsignor Guido Marini now. They are responsible for deciding and for putting together the booklet. Obviously, they'll consult with various people concerned, and it's certainly the case. The basic structure of this liturgy is the office of the Roman Rite, the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul. There certainly will have been a considerable input on the part of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity, which is very involved in this because it's an ecumenical occasion in the sense that representatives of other churches are invited.
And our thanks there go to the abbot of the Benedictine Monastery of St. Paul's outside the walls, Edmund Power. Finally, I'd like to mark this week dedicated to Christian Unity on a more musical note. So do stay tuned as we join Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Canterbury Cathedral, there's a monument to a fine English composer, Orlando Gibbons. Now, you could be forgiven for thinking in that case he must have lived or worked there, but actually he didn't. He died there. For most of his adult life, he was an organist at the Chapel Royal. In the year 1625, when he was just 42 years old, he was travelling with the court of the new king, Charles I, to meet Queen Henrietta Maria, whom the king had recently married by proxy in Paris. The court got as far as Canterbury when Gibbons died of apoplexy, leaving behind a widow and seven children. Here's the beginning of one of his best-known works, a madrigal called The Silver Swan. Like the swan in the madrigal, Gibbons had already produced plenty of fine music long before his sudden death. He wrote a fair amount of instrumental music and a few other madrigals, but he's best remembered for his church music. I'd like to play you the start of his joyful eight-part setting of the psalm, O Clap Your Hands Together.
O clap your hands together,
O clap your hands together.
No doubt it was Gibbons who wrote that piece, but some people say a contemporary of his, William Heather, submitted it to Oxford University for the degree of Doctor of Music. I'm sure that was cheating, but you'll be pleased to know Gibbons got the degree as well. Quite late in his life, Gibbons had some hymn tunes published. He contributed 17 tunes to a collection that was printed in 1623. Some of them are still sung today, usually to texts written more recently. You might recognise this one, sung rather more slowly than we sing it today. That was Forth in Thy Name, O Lord, I Go. In this week of prayer for Christian unity, some of you may find yourselves singing one of Gibbon's best tunes to the words, O Thou who at Thy Eucharist didst pray that all Thy church might be for ever one. St. John's Gospel in chapter 17 includes our Lord's wonderful prayer during the Last Supper, Father, may they all be one, even as you and I are one. That text is very much in our minds during this week of prayer for Christian unity. And it was very much in the mind of William Turton, who wrote the words of this hymn around 1880. The Eucharist, of course, is the great sacrament of unity, the mystery through which God's people are gathered together to become one bread, one body. The hymn has a refrain which reminds us of this. Turton's hymn ends with a beautiful reflection on the church in heaven, when sacraments shall cease, when the church will be truly one with all the saints above, in one unbroken peace, in one unbounded love. Then our Lord's prayer will be perfectly fulfilled. Then the church will be one with the Trinity in unity.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And now I'd like you to join me as we find out more about a woman whose heroic virtues were recognised by Pope Benedict XVI on December 19, 2009. I'll be doing this with Sister Frances Orchard, the Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, as the Roman branch of Mary Ward's Institute has been known since 2003, the other branch maintaining the previous title, Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
This is the story of a saintly woman, condemned by the church she loved and sought to serve.
A saintly woman by the name of Mary Ward, who lived at a time when universities were still doubting whether women actually possessed souls. One, an artist of her day, portrayed with a determined, searching, alert expression of the eyes.
She had this firm belief that women were capable of apostolic work within the church. And this went completely contrary to the thinking of the time, particularly the thinking in Rome in the church, who took the view that religious women, or women in general, should either be married or, as they used to say, behind a wall.
Sister Frances Orchard, Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, recently sat down with me here in our studios and explained the historical backdrop which eventually led to women religious being enclosed behind walls. A situation Mary Ward had no doubts about. It needed redressing.
As many of the problems of the church before the Reformation were to do with loose living in convents and monasteries, the Council of Trent had re-emphasised the requirement of women religious to be enclosed. So the concept of an apostolic congregation of women was something the church had never experienced, couldn't imagine. I often think a bit like with Galileo, of whom Mary Ward was a contemporary, a conceptual leap was required, and that was just too much for the church at that time.
Galileo, like Mary Ward, lived under the certificate of Urban VIII,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
And Gregory the 15th before that. They kind of shared this view that women should, you know, stay in their place in their convents behind walls. But she didn't give up, did she?
No, absolutely not, because she was so utterly convinced that this need for an apostolic religious women's congregation came from God. It wasn't just her idea. She just felt she couldn't give up. She had to continue trying to persuade the church that this was a work that could be done. It was a work that the church needed. And of course, she came from Northern Europe and from England at a time of persecution, where it was the women of the great households who kept the faith alive.
Keeping the faith alive, as Sister Frances says with a hint of emotion in her voice, was what Mary Ward was accustomed to as she grew up in late 16th century England, in her own staunchly Catholic Yorkshire family, and indeed continued doing when she left home.
It was the women in cities such as London, and Mary Ward worked in London with her companions, who would provide the safe houses for the priests, who would prepare the people for the Mass, prepare the children for the sacraments. Without the women, there is, I think, no doubt the Catholic faith might have died out in England, as it did in a place like Sweden, where it was made so difficult for Catholics. But Mary Ward wasn't the only woman. There were similar Catholic women who saw this as their task, ensuring that Catholicism was not destroyed by persecution. She was imprisoned several times in London for harbouring priests, or just because she was known to be, as they would have said in those days, a papist and an influential papist. But she had friends in high places, and she usually got off with a warning. But other sisters were less fortunate. Some of them were imprisoned for much longer periods of time.
Is persecution the reason why she came to Rome and eventually travelled a little bit around Europe, Germany, Prague, Bratislava, Vienna?
You see, her first desire was to be a nun of the strictest enclosed order that she could find. That was the only model of religious life that existed.
And that's where she started, wasn't it?
That's where she started. She started with the Poor Clares, and she was very happy with the Poor Clares, but then became convinced that God was calling her to something else. She went back to London, collected around her a group of similar-minded young women who, because convents didn't exist in England at that time, if they were to serve the church, then they needed to do it, being around, offering open houses, preparing people for the sacraments, conducting spiritual conversation, doing whatever was needed.
A way of living, this, that raised many eyebrows among the male, largely conservative clerics who came across Mary Ward and her companions, deriding them to the extent of dubbing them galloping girls.
I mean, so much so that the Archbishop of Canterbury, George Abbott, said of Mary Ward at one stage,
"She was doing more damage than six Jesuits."
Of course, she was very much inspired by Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits.
Very much inspired by Ignatius of Loyola.
You mentioned earlier how Mary Ward felt that God was calling her to something different. But she had confirmation of this in a vision, no?
What we call her vision of what God was calling to her came to her, interestingly enough, while she was doing her hair one day in front of the mirror. You know, not many religious congregations, I think, are founded by someone who's doing her hair in the morning. But Mary Ward was in lodgings in the Strand, close to St Clement Danes, and doing her hair, and went through an experience whereby she said afterwards, time just disappeared, and she was amazed to find that 2 hours had gone by. But what she heard over and over again, that she was being called to do something that would be to the glory of God. Glory, glory, glory. We call it her glory vision. And it's that vision that happened, we're almost certain, sometime in late 1609, that explains why we are beginning our celebrations of the 400th year of Mary Ward's foundation this year in 2009. Then what she did with her companions, she decided they needed a period of prayer and discernment. So, as so often happened when they needed that, they went back across the channel to the Netherlands, to Saint-Omer, where they spent their time in prayer and in penance, trying to find what it was that God wanted for them.
I understood that the work to be done was not in a Carmelite convent, but a thing that would please God far more and give him greater glory than I can say. But I was not told any particulars about what the work was to be or how it was to be done.
And then 2 years later, in 1611, in a similar interior vision, she heard the words,
"Take same of the society."
Understanding by that the Society of Jesus. By taking the same, it means what we would call the institutum and constitutions and manner of life of the Jesuits. Not to be dependent on the Jesuits, she never wanted that. A separate congregation. What she felt so called to was the focus on the apostolic life. This is what Ignatius was called to, the following of Jesus in whatever was needed, wherever it was needed. I think we would say today to go where the need is greatest. That meant, as with the Jesuits, they went off all over Europe, they went off to Latin America, Francis Xavier went off to India. And that has been the hallmark of the Jesuits, to be totally available to the needs of the church wherever the Pope wants to send them. That's what Mary Ward wanted. She actually said at one time, even to the Turks. Now, in those days, to go to the Turks, of course, meant to go to the infidel. And that would have been completely and utterly impossible for anybody, even the Jesuits, because they wouldn't have survived for a moment. But that was an indication of, if the church asked her to do that, she and her women would be ready to do it. Over time, things developed and the church began to recognise in the 19th century the power of women in the church to do good for the church through education and social work and medical work. And so you get the development of the apostolic religious congregations, but only 300 years after Mary Ward, and one or two other similarly minded women felt called by God to do this. Angela de Merici, Jean de Lestenac, and so on, all contemporaries of Mary Ward. Mary Ward refused to compromise. That, in a sense, was her strength, but also her undoing. She just said, "I cannot compromise. This is not my idea. This is what God is asking me to do." But what must have been so difficult for her, because she was a very loyal daughter of the church, to be in this conflict situation, utterly convinced that God was asking this of her, but at the same time the church, on whose behalf she was doing it, saying, "Absolutely no. Women are staying in convents, women cannot govern themselves," and therefore she submitted and she obeyed. What they actually wrote in the famous Bull of Suppression of 1631...
Signed by the Pope.
Signed by the Pope, by Urban VIII, was that because these women are succeeding, therefore they must be completely and utterly suppressed.
Free from the laws of enclosure, they wander about at will, and under the guise of promoting the salvation of souls, have been accustomed to attempt to employ themselves at many other works which are most unsuited to their weak sex and character. We have decreed that such great temerity must be repressed by sharper censure, and that the poisonous growths in the Church of God must be torn up from the roots, lest they spread themselves further. And therefore, after mature consideration, we decree and declare that the presented congregation of women called Jesuitesses is from its beginning null and void. And because indeed they have made progress, we totally and completely suppress and extinguish them subject them to perpetual abolition, and remove them entirely from the Holy Church of God.
Mary Ward's Institute, which could have numbered as many as 400 women by that date, because it was gaining ground and because the rulers, particularly in southern Germany, were encouraging it. They wanted schools for their daughters. They were putting Mary Ward's sisters under their protection. I think the authorities felt if we don't repress this now, we're never going to be able to do it. But, you see, what Mary Ward was asking for was nothing that the Church hadn't already approved. The Church had approved the Jesuit Institutum and Constitutions, and in fact not only approved, but encouraged and gave tremendous privileges to enable the Jesuits to do the work. But a woman comes along and asks for the same thing. Shock, horror, no. Women cannot do this work. One cleric actually said in the end,
"They are but women."
To these words, Mary Ward promptly replied,
"Fervour is not placed in feelings, but in a will to do well, which women may have as well as men. There is no such difference between men and women that women may not do great things."
Mary Ward's words may have fallen on deaf ears in her lifetime, but eventually the power of her pioneering courage and charism was recognised, and in 1982, Pope John Paul II, while on an apostolic journey on English soil, publicly paid tribute to her.
"An extraordinary Yorkshire woman, Mary Ward, who became a pioneer of the active, unenclosed congregations for women."
The Apostolic Institute, founded by Mary Ward in the early 17th century, was confirmed by the Church in 1877 under the name of the Institute of the Blessed Virgin Mary. However, only in 909 did Mary Ward receive official recognition as its foundress. In 1978, with the approval of the Society of Jesus, Mary Ward's company was granted the Jesuit Constitutions, for which she had pleaded in 1621. In 2003, the Roman branch of Mary Ward's Institute adopted the full Jesuit Constitutions and the title Congregation of Jesus, following the original vision of Mary Ward. Both branches look to Mary Ward as their foundress, and with so much to share, are becoming increasingly associated with each other's apostolic work and interpretation of Mary Ward's charism.
"The true children of this company shall accustom themselves to act not out of fear, but solely from love, because we are called by God to a vocation of love."
Warm thanks there go to the Vicar General of the Congregation of Jesus, Sister Frances Orchard. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.